Welcome to the WGBH Forum Network weekly lecture series. From politics to poetry, science to satire, listen in and enjoy.
Welcome to the Cambridge Forum discussing democracy in the press, the role of journals of opinion with Victor Novasky, Jack Beatty, and Robert Kuttner. I'm Mark Cherkowitz, the media critic for the Boston Phoenix. Question tonight is, what role does the old-fashioned journal of opinion have in today's changing media landscape? Are they, with their commitment to in-depth reporting and informed partisanship, the closest thing we have to a free press? Or are they dinosaurs falling into extinction before internet news services and blogs? Our speakers are eminently qualified to address these questions. Together, they will investigate the decline in public confidence in traditional media and the role of the press in maintaining democracy. I'll introduce the speakers now, and then we'll hear from them individually before beginning our discussion. Victor Novasky, to my far right, is currently publisher emeritus at The Nation. He joined The Nation in 1978 and became its publisher in 1994. His experiences steering the weekly through 27 years of dissent and nearly always deficit are captured in his recent book, A Matter of Opinion. Jack Beatty, in the middle, is a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly, where he's worked since 1983. Prior to that, he served as literary editor at the New Republic. In addition to his award-winning journalism, he's authored two biographies of Boston Mayor James Michael Curley and business guru Peter Drucker. Most recently, he edited Paul's, a collection of political profiles. And sitting next to me is Robert Kuttner, the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. An economist by training, he has authored six books, including the award-winning Everything for Sale in 1997. He writes a regular column on politics and economics for the Boston Globe. I'd like to start by asking each of our speakers to address the basic question of this forum. What is the role of the Journal of Opinion in today's media landscape? And we'll start with Victor Novasky.
Thank you. This basic question, are they relics of the 18th century, or are they a counterforce to all of the degrading, the problems of contemporary journalism, under which I would put the Murdochization of the media, the homogenization of the media, the conglomeratization of the media, the bureaucratization of the media, the Oprahfication of the media, and of course you haven't invited any bloggers to address this, so you may get a uniformity of opinion. But those who say that they are relics of the past generally list four or five things. They of course list the blogosphere. They list the fact that they're on the brink of bankruptcy always. They list the fact that they have tiny circulations, and they list the fact that they preach to the choir, and they list the fact that they are ideological, and that these are all limiting factors for these journals. So I'd like to just run down, I'll save the blogosphere for last, each of these charges against us and tell you why I think they're misplaced. I'm giving away my position in advance. So those who say that they are perpetually on the brink of bankruptcy, they're right. They are perpetually on the brink of bankruptcy. Of course, the miracle is that magazines like Saturday Evening Post and Collier's and Look and Life, with circulations in the millions, have gone under, and these little journals, The Nation, The New Republic, National Review, among them, and The Atlantic Monthly, which is a journal of ideas more than the journal of opinion. But these little journals have survived where these other, and in the magazine business, survival is the ultimate test of success. And when we were introduced, we were told this is the birthday of Frederick Law Olmsted. I have correspondence here between the founder of The Nation, E.L. Godkin, and Olmsted, and actually, there's a letter talking about all the nation's financial problems because it ran out of capital the first year. And what's interesting, there are two things that are of interest to this. One is he says in the letter that Olmsted's coming in relieves my mind. Olmsted became an associate editor of The Nation for a few months in the first year. And it was, he was in correspondence and conversation about it before it was founded in 1865, the year the Civil War ended. And Godkin says, Olmsted's coming in relieves my mind a good deal, particularly in ridding me of the hateful burden of over-caution. And then he goes on, but then he says, but Bowles, who is a friend of theirs, tells me that Emerson took back from here the news or the idea that Olmsted had supplanted me. This report I care nothing for. The only fear I had about his coming in was that it might seem an endorsement by more respectable men of Stearns's attack on my character. What he's talking about there is that there was a guy, Major Stearns, who was the largest shareholder in The Nation. And Stearns was very upset that the magazine was not following the radical Reconstructionist line, which Stearns believed in. And so Stearns threatened to pull out. And at most magazines, when the largest shareholder or the owner doesn't like what the editor is doing, you fire the editor. But at The Nation, he basically fired his larger shareholder. And he reorganized the company and replaced the shareholders who, it wasn't that they didn't agree with him, but that they tried to tell him what to do. He wanted to be able to run an independent journal. And this happened later in the career when Maurice Wertheim, who was an investment banker in the career of The Nation in the 1930s, called in Frieda Kirschwey because the magazine had come out for Roosevelt's court packing plan. And he said to her, you know, I'm getting a lot of flack from my Wall Street confreres. This can't go on. And so she, you know, in another magazine, he would have said, so get packing, you're fired, I'll bring in a new editor. He said, and so I'm selling you the magazine, and I want $30,000 for it. And she said, I only have $15,000. So he lent her the other $15,000. So to this day, you know, anyone who knows The Nation knows that we don't have any money in the sense that, you know, Calvin Trillin, the humorist, our humor writer, has made a living off of claiming that we pay him in the high two figures. And he goes on The Tonight Show and says that and gets a lot of laughs. It was my line. I told him we were thinking of paying him in the high two figures. We paid him $100 a column, not a penny less than a penny more. And then he started writing a weekly poem. And he had the nerve to write a poem one week that was two words, which makes him the highest paid poet in the world, I think. I've committed the poem to memory, just in case you're in. The poem was about the O.J. Simpson case, and it went like this: O.J. Oy vey. So much for the argument that these magazines are underfinanced. The last 3 years, by the way, The Nation, I had to send a letter of apology to their shareholders. We made a little money. I had promised them that they'd get a tax list. They didn't get it. So. Okay. Now, the argument that they have a tiny circulation, of course they have a tiny circulation. I've told you, though, that the, you know, the large magazines that went under. But, you know, magazines with tiny circulations tend to break big stories every once in a while. Remember the Iran-Contra connection, and President Reagan said, this is a rumor spread by a Lebanese rag, which was a tiny Lebanese journal of opinion. And it was, of course, Mother Jones that broke these stories about the cars that were unsafe, and it was The Nation back when Fred Cook was writing about the FBI and the CIA, when no one would write about these things that helped put new issues on the national agenda. And Bob Kuttner will tell you stories about what the American Prospect has done that no one else is doing. There's a freedom that comes with it. And it's not just, you know, every once in a while, someone will lose a job because you report something. But that's not the main contribution they make. They influence the intellectual current of the time. And the greatest compliment to the magazine is not when they quote you in an editorial in the New York Times. It's when they have something in there that they couldn't have done without you, and you know it, and they don't quote you. That you're part of the intellectual framework of the country at the time. The criticism that these magazines are ideological, to me, it has no merit, because I believe they are ideological, but so is the New York Times, and so is NBC and CBS. It's different. The only difference is Nation has the ideology this week of the left because the country has moved so far to the right. National Review has the ideology of the right, and the major media have the ideology of the center. And it is part of the ideology of the center not to admit that you have an ideology, to deny that you have an ideology. And we can, in the question period, if you're interested, get into what it means to have the ideology of the center. And then the last criticism of these journals is that they preach to the choir, so who cares? And, of course, anyone who's read The Nation's letters page knows that if it preaches to the choir, it's the least harmonious choir in the history of American journalism. And I just want to read you a typical letter that I get, which is an example from one of our contributors, longtime contributors, Bob Sherrill, who's a great writer, and who I'd say I got there in 1978. I'd say barely 2 years went by that I didn't receive a letter of resignation from him for one or another reason. This is, I'm only going to quote one paragraph from his letter of resignation of a few years ago. Anyway, Victor, you and I aren't on the same wavelength. You are an Eastern liberal, extremely clever, very intellectual, very reasonable. I am not an Eastern liberal. I'm a Western anarchist, and I'm not clever, not at all intellectual, and very unreasonable. You talk over my head. I never can remember all the Borgian feuds and neoliberal intellectuals who are supposed to be our enemies. You do that beautifully, and doubtless it is worth doing. But I think I hate corporations much better than you do. Though I'll admit it is not a very sophisticated hatred. And I know damn well that I hate politicians better than you do, though the hatred is downright gutter. So we really don't have much to talk about, and I guess it's just as well we didn't get together much. And don't make me a contributing editor. That is the dumbest and most meaningless title ever concocted by a profession that spends half its time doing dumb and meaningless things. Just take me off the masthead. You know I wish you well indeed. This is a typical Sherrill letter. So let me say now a word about the other part of the topic tonight, these journals of opinion and democracy, and then a word about the blogosphere, and I'm done. You know, when I sat down to write this book, A Matter of Opinion, one of the reasons I did it was I thought that no one had ever written such a book before about a meditation on the role of journals of opinion. And I quickly discovered I was wrong, that indeed someone had written such a book, and it was the Frankfurt philosopher Jürgen Habermas. And the first half of a book that he published in 1962 in Germany is a history of the Journal of Opinion. One of the reasons I think that a lot of people didn't know about it, including me, was the catchy title he gave his book. It was published in English 25 years later under the title The Structural Transformation of the Public Sphere, an Inquiry into a Category of Bourgeois Society. But his thesis was that these journals, which grew out of the taverns and coffee houses of the 18th century and became, they each started where you had free and open debate, where the winner of the debate was the person who had the better argument, not the person who had the higher station in the church or in the court. They started publishing magazines, and the Spectator came out of one of these taverns, and the Tatler came out of one of these coffee houses. So he traced those magazines, and it is, and I actually, I taught here 1 year at the Institute of Politics, and Bob Kuttner was kind enough to come, and I tried to get Habermas to come, and he wouldn't come, so I went over to see him over there, and I got to ask him the question that we were asked this evening: what is the role of these journals in this age of where all this other degrading stuff is going on, of mass media and electric media and new media? And his answer to you will sound like a cliche. To me, it had the clarity of the Liberty Bell, because I had been worrying this question for far too long. And finally he said, you know, well, it's the answer is simple. He said, at the core of their mission is to maintain the discursive character of public communications. Who else, if not this type of press, is going to set the standards? So it's to set the standards for public discourse, which is not a bad mission to have if you're in this business. So my last comment is only on the blogosphere, and my children tell me I don't get it, and they're right, I don't get it, but I do get it. The Nation has a website, but the prediction that these websites were going to put these artifacts of print out of business didn't happen. And in the Nation's case, what happened to us was that it turned out, and one of the reasons that I believe that this new media is going to be like the paperback is to the hardcover, it's going to extend the audience for it rather than replace it the way talkies replace silent movies, is partly because of our experience. When I became the publisher of The Nation about 15 years ago, I did a very careful prospectus, and we based the business prospectus to attract new investment capital to the magazine. And we based it on all of our experience, and we predicted we'd break even within 3 years, which of course didn't happen. But one of the words that was missing from that prospectus was the internet or the blogosphere or the web. And in fact, last year, when I got to Nation in 78, we had 20,000 subscribers. Last year, we got 40,000 paying subscribers to the hard copy magazine who came to us over our free website. So it's not just a content provider, it's a place that can attract things to the real content providers, the journals of opinion. So I want to close now by just saying that to me, these journals do something else that I have not included in my rundown of the various things they do, putting new issues on the agenda, et cetera. And again, this time I want to read you from something from a voicemail message. So it's a new technology that I found on my phone about the time that I was finishing my book. And it was from a 68-year-old widow who I had met 40 years earlier. She was the widow of a great civil rights reporter named Pat Waters. And her name was Glenda Waters. And she said, Victor, we only met once. She said, and this is what she left on my phone. I need to ask a favor of you. I'm stuck in Abbeville, Louisiana, and I want to move. But I want to move somewhere where I can see a Democrat before I die. It occurs to me that you might be able to rummage up a place where people are actually subscribers to The Nation, where I would have someone to talk to. I don't want their names or anything. I just want a town where there are a few kindred souls. And she added, if you could call around noon, I'd be grateful. I'm about to cut the grass. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Victor. Next to take a crack at this is Jack Beatty of the Atlantic Monthly, which, if you believe printed reports, also has a proud history of losing money.
Every year since 1857, actually. Who can add anything to that comprehensive analysis? Let me just add a footnote that's probably been true of journals of opinion forever, but now, when there are so many more places people looking for opinion can go, it may be truer than ever, and that is, these are very risky enterprises. People buy journals like that almost in the way they go to a church. They want their Herbert Crowley, the man who started the New Republic, said that the aim of the New Republic when he started was to promote little insurrections in the realm of its readers' opinions. Well, you know, the fact is, readers don't want those insurrections. They want predictability. They want their inner convictions confirmed through these publications in a way that they don't care about from the New York Times. And my examples are, in Washington, I was a neighbor of I.F. Stone, and he had a weekly that he published for about 20 years, and it was quite wonderful, a muckraking, hard pavement reporting. And I asked him once, I said, "What have you ever had trouble with your subscribers?" He said, "I nearly went out of business twice. Once when I went to the Soviet Union after Khrushchev's speech, and I, 57, I guess, and I came back and I wrote a piece saying, this is a failure. This is a gray, dead, soulless place. Everything I thought was noble about this experiment I was just fooled. We were all fooled. It's a ghastly affliction on history. He said he nearly had to go out of business. That's the last thing his readers wanted to hear from him, because he had begun as a kind of popular front journalist in the 30s. They didn't want to hear that. So I said, what was the other one? And the other one nearly, I think it helped to persuade him to get out of business after a while, was after President Kennedy was assassinated, President Johnson appointed a commission under Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren to investigate the Kennedy assassination. And they published a 26-volume report that basically said there was no conspiracy. Oswald did it. And it was attacked from all quarters and is still being attacked. Well, Izzy may be the only person extant who read every word of this thing. That's the other thing. He read everything. And he wrote it. He came out with a piece saying, I defend this report. I think they're right. And moreover, even if they're wrong, it's nothing we need to speculate about. Conspiracy theories just, by their nature, prevent our going forward. We'll always be trying to. And so he said that the volume of mail and cancellations, and his wife Esther was there at the time, and she just gestured. In other words, people did not want to hear that from him. Another example would be the current New Republic, which is dear to my heart. I have been a subscriber since 1964. I love the publication. I think it's a great magazine. But before the Iraq War, they came out for the war. And I think it cost them 30 or, I don't want to know how many, a dramatic cut in circulation. Just such that when you read what their circulation is today, it was, they used to be so much bigger. And when the editors did that, they had to have known they were going to lose, probably they didn't realize they were going to lose so many, but that they were going to lose readers. But they went ahead and did it anyway. And people don't care what the New York Times endorses. I mean, that people read it. But they really care when one of these magazines crosses them. They didn't sign, they don't want those insurrections. I don't want them. I don't read the New Republic to have my convictions insurrected. I want information. I want analysis. I also want strengthening of my views. But it's just darn risky to cross your readers when you've got a business that's a quasi-church. It's a little bit like, how much heresy do you expect us to abide in this here church? And the answer is not much. And so they're brave ventures to recognize you're going to lose a third of your readers, but you believe in what you believe, and you're going to come out and do it. Well, I think that's one of the real risks of these publications, that when they try to cross their readers and try to, do what Crowley said, they really get in trouble. And now with the Internet, there are so many other places people can go once they're off the New Republic. Will they come back? I hope so, but I don't know. They have other places they can go, so many other places, so easily. And the statement that reading the New Republic was had just changed for them. So I really think these are very, they're it's the church-like character of them that makes them just so risky. They have freedom, but they have, freedom, and they have the range, really, of what are the Tallulah Bankhead's acting, all the range from A to B. I mean, you can't get much beyond that without really getting your readers very angry at you, and they will stop subscribing. So that's the point I would underline, how risky, intrinsically risky, these publications are.
And Jack, it's worth noting that the New Republic was among a number of publications, including the Washington Post, the New York Times, and God help us, Bill O'Reilly, that actually later admitted that they were sort of wrong and misinformed in the run-up to the war of Iraq and
That's
offered
right.
a mea culpa of sorts.
That's right.
Thank you. Our next speaker, Robert Kuttner.
Thank you. I'm the baby here. we founded the Prospect in late 1988, started publishing in the early 1990. As both my colleagues here suggested, it's an insane thing to do, to try and found a magazine. But it's wonderful fun. In addition to being a high public calling, and a bunch of us founded the Prospect because we felt that little magazines can exert big influence, and we, first of all, had watched what the right had done so successfully. It had used the power of ideas to build a movement. The Republican Party today is a movement party. The Democratic Party today is not a movement party, and that's one of the reasons why the Republicans, until very recently, have had energy and discipline and ideological conviction. And you can trace back to the National Review and the Public Interest Quarterly and literally dozens of specialized right-wing magazines on foreign policy, on cultural issues. And of course, the other reason why the right was so successful at this was that for the first time, really, in the history of the Republic, you had a rendezvous of intellectual horsepower and business money. So that whereas Victor and I have to go around with our tin cup and try and keep our publications afloat, once a year, the editors of the Weekly Standard go to Mr. Murdoch, and Mr. Murdoch writes them a check. And that's the extent of their fundraising. The alliance of big money and intellectual horsepower is incredibly powerful. And it built a movement. Now, I want to leave you with two paradoxes that I think about a lot. Number one, this is the age, of course, of the Internet. And yet, I would argue, it is the golden age of the magazine. I think like anybody else who edits a magazine or publishes a magazine, I'm a complete print junkie. And the happiest point in my week is when my New Yorker or my Atlantic Monthly or my New York Review or my Nation or my Harper's I read all of them, arrives. And, you know, you pick the thing up and, wow, here's Cy Hirsch with some amazing new revelation. And here's Henry Siegman in the New York Review sort of breaking the party line on Palestine and Israel. And here's Jim Fallows on why Iraq doesn't have an army. And you just say, God, this is wonderful. I wish The Prospect had published all of this stuff. And then we have our own, if I can plug the magazine, the current issue has just a marvelous piece by Bob Dreyfus on how Dick Cheney actually goes about running the government, a piece that the mainstream press just kind of never bothered to get around to reporting. And if you, my wife calls it the bubble, 02138 or 02146 or kindred progressive bubble communities. If you live in the bubble and you read The Nation and The New York Review and The New Yorker and The Atlantic, you would say to yourself, God, it's over. Bush is finished. That brings me to my second paradox. It's a golden age of magazine journalism, idea mongering, reportorial enterprise, investigative pieces. I think the magazines, the little magazines like us and the medium-sized magazines like the Atlantic and the New Yorker, just run rings around the New York Times and the Washington Post. It's a golden age of magazines and magazine journalism, and yet why isn't it making more of a difference? And that's actually the subject of the book that I'm working on, which is why all of the issues that matter seem impervious to politics. Why is it, for example, that for 30 years the living standards of the average American have been taking it on the chin, but this is not topic A for either political party, and it ought to be? Why is it that our health system and our pension system are both collapsing, and this is not topic B? And you can, I've got a list of nine. Books with numbers in the title are said to sell better, so my subtitle is Nine Failures of Politics. But we can talk about this some more in the discussion. It's a real paradox that the virtuosity an enterprise of magazine journalism has never been better, and in some ways its influence on what happens in politics has never been weaker. That may change. I mean, the Bush administration is finally falling of its own weight, and just when you despair about the future of the Republic, the wheel turns, and maybe in retrospect we can say that these magazines will have played an important role. We like to think that one of the things we do is to shame the mainstream media into doing its job better. But it's very good news that, and I very much echo what Victor said about this, the wonderful paradox that the internet, that's supposed to lend itself to short attention spans and quick bursts of blogging, continues to validate itself in terms of the print press and continues to be a kind of feeder of readers for the print press. So when the ultimate liberal blogger, the fellow who writes Daily Kos, Marcos Melitzis, wants to validate himself and demonstrate that he's not just a kibitzer, he's the real deal, he writes a book. And, you know, Slate, which is very clever in many respects, even whatever year of the internet this is, year 10, year 12, Slate and Salon continue to be ephemeral. So I think the good news is that these magazines are going to continue. Their financial status is always the perils of Pauline. The more serious question, and it has to do with the issue that is in the title of this program, the relationship of these magazines to democracy. And the fact that all of this wonderful journalism is not having more of an effect on the public policy and the politics of the nation, nation lowercase n, our country, is more an indictment of the state of our democracy than it is a statement about the condition of magazine journalism.
Thank you, Bob. I want to remind everybody that you're joining us at the Cambridge Forum, listening to Victor Novasky, Jack Beatty, and Robert Kuttner discussing journals of opinion. Each of you represents a somewhat different publication. Would you each quickly give us a profile, philosophical as well as physical, of your magazine and tell us how what you are affects what you are able to accomplish? Just a reminder to our panelists also, please identify yourself for our listening audience before making your question or comment. And this time I'll start with you, Bob.
Well, as I said a moment ago, I mean, we started thinking about this right after Michael Dukakis lost the 1988 election. And one of the memorable things that Dukakis, who I admire very much, I think he was a terrific governor, and he's an admirable elder statesman, but one of the things that he said memorably in one of the debates was, this is not about ideology, this is about competence. And for that remark, I would adjudge him ideologically incompetent because great public choices are, of course, about ideology. Ideology is another word for public philosophy. What are your beliefs, and how are you going to govern the country in light of those beliefs? We felt that the fact that the right was very feisty, the right had built a movement on intellectual energy, and that formerly liberal magazines were repairing to the center-right. Several of us who organized The Prospect were refugees from the New Republic. I don't share the same fondness that Jack does for the New Republic. I think it was a once great liberal magazine that's become a kind of opportunistic center-right magazine, and that's a whole other conversation too. But we felt that the fact that the Washington Monthly, which in some ways is a wonderful magazine, but in those years, it was a kind of neoliberal magazine that took pot shots at the public sector, the labor movement. The fact that the New Republic had moved from center-left to center-right left a huge void. And the nation in those years often seemed consumed by sectarian infighting, although I would say today there's not much philosophical difference between the current nation and the current prospect. But at the time, we felt that the absence of a mainstream, resolutely progressive magazine was part of what was pushing the country to the right. And so we wanted to reclaim as legitimate a certain set of core principles. Number one, be very wary of allowing the free market to do everything. If concentrated wealth has too much power, it ruins democracy itself. It ruins the ability of a society to have a mixed economy. We wanted to reclaim the case for competent, well-run activist government. In those years, the mark of a mature liberal was someone who didn't like government very much either. We thought that was a very self-destructive idea, because the only thing ultimately that differentiates liberals from conservatives in domestic policy is first of all the idea that rights need to be expanded rather than narrowed, and secondly the fact that you have to rely on government to do certain things that the private sector simply cannot do either equitably or competently. So we wanted to reclaim what was essentially a Roosevelt ideology and shame the Democratic Party into re-embracing it and bring it up to date and articulate it in a forceful way so that it would be credible to a basically liberal readership that was beginning to lose heart and to liberal politicians who often didn't seem to have the courage of their convictions or even know what their convictions were. Secondarily, we wanted to do what effective magazines always do, and that was to incubate a new generation of public intellectuals who were not slavish adherents of a party line, but who basically shared the public philosophy that we did. And one of the things we're proudest of is all of the alums who we have worked with and trained and turned loose on the rest of journalism. And we thought we were going to do it as a little magazine, a quarterly. One of our role models was the Public Interest Quarterly, very much intellectually serious, anti-public sector, pro-free market, backlash magazine run by very, very serious intellectuals, neoconservatives, many of them former liberals, or even former socialists. And as we were all, and when I say we, it's Paul Starr, Bob Reich. In those years, it was also Rick Hertzberg, who went on to the New Yorker, Sid Blumenthal, who went on to work for the Clinton administration, and a few other people. We said to ourselves, well, how often shall we publish this thing? And of course, the answer was, well, how much money can we raise? And when we had raised $250,000, we commenced publication as a quarterly. Well, it turned out that it was much more difficult to raise a relatively small amount of money for a quarterly than it was to raise a larger amount of money for a magazine that claimed larger ambitions. And so for 15 years, we kept falling upwards, because that's what it took to persuade donors to write checks. And in some ways, I missed the quarterly, because when it was a quarterly, I had a life. You know, I could write other articles. I was writing long articles for The Atlantic in the mid-80s that gave me great satisfaction. I could write books. In those years, I was writing a book every 3 or 4 years. But when you publish monthly, and at one point we were publishing biweekly every other week, it's just all-consuming. And I think the premise was that by being more frequent, bigger circulation, we'd have more influence. And I suspect in some ways we have. So what I hope we have accomplished, and I think the difference between us and the nation continues to be, even though the ideology has a 70 or 80% overlap, we are trying very hard to talk to and influence the conversation of mainstream politics. And I remember a letter from somebody saying, God, why bother? You people seem to care a lot about rescuing the Democratic Party. Why bother? And that's our stance. We think there's no practical alternative. We've tried very hard not to be sectarian, not to be the left with a capital L, rehashing the same arguments. And I think in recent years, the nation, to its great credit, has moved away from that as well. I think in many respects, we're all children of Michael Harrington, who memorably said that his goal was to be on the left edge of the possible. And I think that's our goal. I suspect it's Victor's goal.
Jack, what about the Atlantic, which, of course, has recently moved from Boston to Washington, D.C.? We were all at that party at the Harvard Club, that going-away party, where a lot of nostalgia mixed with sadness.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about your publication and what the move might mean in terms of its content and format.
Yeah, just to quickly give the two-sentence history of the Atlantic, it was started in this city the year of the, just months after the Dred Scott decision came down. And it was founded by people who were abolitionists, James Russell Lowell, Ralph Waldo Emerson, others. And they founded the magazine to essentially, as Lowell put it in an editorial, to resist the encroachment of the slave power everywhere and everywhen. And it agitated for abolition. It advocated Lincoln's election and then pushed him and kept pushing and pushing and pushing on the subject of abolition because, of course, Lincoln was very reluctant first 2.5 years of the war because he needed the border states to push the issue of abolition. But the Atlantic pushed it. And that, I think, was really its main opinion for the next 60 or 50 years or so. I mean, it published Frederick Douglass during Reconstruction. It, when the nation, under Mr. Godkin, much to the disappointment of some of his Boston benefactors, when the nation turned against, and it was very early, against Reconstruction, and basically said, you know, you can't do anything with these people. I mean, see, look at this, these black legislators drinking champagne in the South Carolina legislature. And they went on about the corruption of Southern legislatures, this at a time when the Grant administration was so thoroughly debauched, when every polity in the country was so thoroughly and gargantuanly debauched, to make a few quibbles about the pickle menu for the South Carolina legislature. Well, that just showed where Godkin's heart was, and it wasn't in rights for black people. But the Atlantic was, and that was its tradition, that was its main opinion. And then in the 80s, just before he left for Harper's, William Dean Howells turned from, and they continue to write pieces about conditions in the South, but like the rest of the country, they really turned the page after the election of 1876. The Howells turned to the questions of industry, and they ran the first muckraking article, Henry Demarest Lloyd's The Great Monopoly, a story of Standard Oil. And that just started that whole period of muckraking. And Lloyd gave us one of the most imperishable sentences, I think, in the magazine's history, and it was, Standard Oil has done everything to the Pennsylvania legislature except refine it. And the magazine, that became its tradition. It continued, it was critical of the monopolies of the trusts, of the degradation of working people. And in the 20th century, it was a generally progressive journal, I mean, always progressive, but not necessarily identified with any party. Its other mission in 1857 was to give a place where the American voice in literature could come through, because even up until the 50s, American publishers and magazines really pretty much stole British publications. They just grabbed stuff out of British magazines, never paid the copyright, and printed them. And the result was American writers had no place to be published. And Lowell, the famous story is, he had a hat full of British manuscripts, and he was crossing the Mass Avenue Bridge, and the wind came and blew the hat off, and off went the British manuscripts. And suddenly, in a magazine was born that would print American literature, the American voice. And so the Atlantic had these two ambitions, and the literary ambition was, which journals of opinion necessarily don't have, was part of its goal all along, publishing Henry James, Mark Twain, T.S. Eliot, Hemingway, Willa Cather, on and on. And it still has that tradition today, only it's more in the realm of literary journalism. That is, articles that are that tell you about public problems, but that do it in a narrative form, in a form that has some of the beguilements and perhaps even imagery of good fiction. Literary journalism, if you will. That's why I think one of the things it does today. And I think the other thing it does that's striking and that's really grows out of the Atlantic tradition is long-form investigative journalism, very factual, very analytical. Jim Fallows would be an example of this. So, and I think someone, even a right-wing Republican, could pick up one of Jim's pieces, and I don't know that they'd ever encounter ideology. What he'd encounter is fact, argument, analysis, the operations of a mind. And I do think that's what the Atlantic presents, that it's not necessarily an ideological point of view. It's good thinking about public policy questions and thinking through them. Jim Fallows' articles about Iraq, before we went in, after, now, were just exhaustive in looking through questions that were just sort of brushed off or that smaller magazines didn't have the space to deal with comprehensively. So I think that's the magazine's contribution today, this long-form narrative journalism and long-form investigative pieces, which I think are its distinguishing mark today. So,
Jack, just a quick follow. The move to Washington, people speculate that that might mean that the magazine is, quote-unquote, more on the news, more politico-centric. Your sense at this point?
You know, I am very grateful that I have my health insurance from the Atlantic, and I write a web column there. But I don't really have any day-to-day dealings, or even week-to-week, or even month-to-month dealings. So I don't know. I have no idea. I rather hope it doesn't go in the direction of current politics too much, because there's lots of other people that do that, and Washington is a narrow place. I mean, it happens to people down there. Their minds just contract, and in the narrow space, it's so full of the latest twist and turn. You know, who did Tom DeLay? Who's his third assistant? And what's the? And it's all this brain power, but within this terribly narrow Washington. And I found that in the Washington Post as soon as I went down there. It just seemed to me, my God, wait a minute, there's a whole country out there. You'd never know it, at least reading the Post back then. And I think the New Republic manages to get out of that. But I hope the Atlantic doesn't succumb to that journalistic Potomac fever, which is, you know, this is America, and what Tom DeLay is thinking next week, or what the staffer up here has up her sleeve, and so on. That... I hope that doesn't happen.
Thank you, Jack. Now let's hear from Victor Nowaski.
The Nation was founded the year the Civil War ended. It had many of the same contributors the Atlantic had. It was originally dedicated to covering the plight of the newly freed slaves. And to me, the sort of spirit of the magazine, although there are a lot of political zigs and zags over the years, and despite its stereotypical reputation, it was not in favor of trade unions, it was in favor of free market economics at the beginning, women were rarely seen around the Nation's office and all of that. There are two sentences in its inception that, to me, stand for what the Nation is and ought to be at its best all about. And the first was the first sentence in the first issue, on the first page, the first paragraph, the first story in that magazine. And to me, it is the most courageous sentence in the history of magazine launches. And here is the sentence. Here is the sentence. Those of you who are interested in starting a magazine, I commend it to you. You can write it down. The weak was singularly barren of exciting events. Now, would Tina Brown have the guts to, you know, ask you? Now, what does that say? What it says is we're not going to be part of the hype of the false sensationalism of pretending there's a story when there isn't a story. There. We're going to tell it like it is. And the other sentence was, when the nation went into business, it inherited the subscription list of a great paper, The Liberator, which was put out by the abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison. And he was known for the following sentence: I will not equivocate, I will not excuse, I will not retreat a single inch, which meant that he and his publication would fight zealously and crusade on behalf of the values and the causes that where they believed justice resided, and on behalf of the disenfranchised, on behalf of the newly freed slaves. And the magazine over the years has been pretty consistent in its fight, and there have been some exceptions, but I'd say 95% of the time, in its fight for political rights, in its fight for human rights, and in its fight for civil liberties, and in its sort of anti-imperialistic stance. Now, in terms of the different eras of the magazine, Godkin let down a lot of his backers. He had worked briefly at the New York Times. He then took the magazine into the New York Evening Post, and it became a supplement in there. And it wasn't until the early 1900s when a railroad man named Henry Villard, who had bought the Evening Post, turned the magazine over to his son, Oswald Garrison Villard, that it took on the political coloration that it has to this day. And Oswald Garrison Villard was something of a pacifist. He helped found the American Civil Liberties Union. He helped found the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. He helped found the Anti-Imperial League. And he was a social activist. He had a falling out with his own magazine, which on the eve of World War II, he'd been opposed to America's involvement in World War I and was opposed to America's involvement in World War II, and Frieda Kirschway, the editor, was writing editorials on behalf of collective security, and he quit in a public dispute. And to this day, I sit in the middle of, or sat in the middle of all these disputes that were going on. Some of them may have been sectarian. Others of them are not sectarian at all. They deal with fundamental problems, but they're very different from the sort of party line publication that one would think of as a magazine of the left would be. For example, we have debates in our pages between radical feminists who believe that pornography ought to be banned and civil libertarians who believe nothing ought to be banned. We have debates in our pages between pacifists who believe, nuclear pacifists who believe in the nuclear age, there is never a reason to go to war, and human rights interventionists who you look at the situation and you have that out. I mean, we have debates between old-fashioned democratic socialists, top-down planners, and bottom-up bioregionalists and Greens, who believe that, you know, old-fashioned big government is a thing of the past and that you ought to organize regionally. So those are debates that you don't see in the mainstream media. They don't fully occupy our pages because the Katrina VandenHeuvel, the editor today, does care about influencing mainstream politics, but not being the prisoner of it. And what one of the answers, I think, Bob, to the question that your book is going to deal with, not all the answers, but one of the answers, has to do with the way the mainstream media play the material that comes out of these journals. On the one hand, they're perfectly happy to steal ideas and steal writers and take some issues and put them on the agenda that they didn't know were there before. On the other hand, they coarsen the dialogue. So that when you hear about opinion journalism today, people think of Bill O'Reilly shouting at someone else, or a crossfire, two people yelling at each other, instead of the kind of moral and political argument that can that you get in a serious journal of the sort that the folks up here have been involved with. And so I think that they are not fulfilling their role, mainstream media, mass media, as part of the national conversation that democracy requires. And at their best, these journals fuse this these two sentences that I spoke about earlier, but also nourish the ideas that become part of the culture over time, and put new issues on the agenda. So,
thank you, Victor. You're listening to Victor Navasky, Jack Beatty, and Robert Kuttner discussing journals of opinion. At this point, I'd like to open the floor up to questions from the audience. If you have anything for any of our panelists here, we'd ask you to come down to the microphone. You can ask a question specifically of one or more panelists or the entire panel, and we will start with you, sir.
I love Victor's point about The Nation. I'm not a regular reader, and I wasn't aware it had such a range of opinion, not only in his letters, its letters come, as he mentioned half an hour ago, but among its articles. My question is for the entire panel. I wonder which of these three marvelous publications has the widest range of opinion among its articles, the greatest illustration of lively national debate in this sense.
Well, I would nominate The Atlantic because Victor's, well, The Nation and The Prospect, I think, have a viewpoint. I mean, it's a broad church viewpoint. We span, you know, from slightly left of center to rather further left of center. I think Victor spans at least as much territory as The Prospect does, but I think The Atlantic is the only, and you can speak to it better than I can, but on foreign policy, I mean, The Atlantic runs neoconservative theorists who I think are truly dangerous, and then it runs people like Jim Fallows, who were basically liberals, but who let the facts dictate the conclusions, and it makes it a very interesting read. But I think it's different in kind, and I think Jack's description of it as literary or narrative journalism, I think, is accurate. It doesn't have the same philosophical compass in this sense.
Well, I agree. I'm going to jump in before Jack, because, I mean, I half agree and half don't. Certainly it's true that neither The Nation nor The American Prospect thinks it's part of our mission to give equal time to Democrats and Republicans. But that's accepting the conventional political framework, and we're, yeah, and by that definition, we're over there somewhere. First of all, in terms of the literary role of these journals, at least speaking for The Nation, going way back, part of its heritage was that it was going to establish standards of excellence in literature, and it was going to publish reviews, essays, and articles. And the old idea that, you know, you run these in the back of the magazine, one of the traditions at The Nation, anyway, was it had two people at the beginning, and one was Godkin, and the other was a relative of Garrison's, Wendell Phillips Garrison, who was the literary editor, and they were separate. It was church state. You didn't interfere. And all the way up through the Cold War, the back of the magazine was running articles that were at war with the ideas of the front of the magazine. And they were held together by staples, and that was, you know, that was the what they had in common. And it was it was a source of a lot of tension. But it was not just political. It also had to do with the modernist theme in literature and all of that. So it's a complicated question. So is there more space between a pacifist than, or less space between a pacifist and a human rights interventionist than a Democrat and Republican? I think there is. So in that sense, it's a different kind of variation of stances that you get in mm-hmm. these magazines. But certainly, yeah, if you're looking at the conventional spectrum, then you get something less than the whole thing from these magazines. The other point I would make, just in response to something that Bob said earlier, that, you know, when they started The Prospect, they wanted to have the success that the conservatives had with their journals. Funnily enough, when Bill Buckley started National Review in the first editorial, he pointed to The Nation and The New Republic as the model that they should imitate as a way to influence what was going on. And in those days, by the way, The New Republic had a lot of influence in the Roosevelt and the New Deal in a directly traceable way. So at different periods, it happens in different ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for the reasons said, The Atlantic would seem to have more variety, but I wouldn't say it was any more, vibrant. There's a wider run of articles by people of different persuasions. Yeah.
Next question.
My name's Rolf Kurtze. I live inside the Blue Bubble, one of the Blue Bubbles, 02138, Cambridge. And I guess I'd like to broaden this if I can. I see us as living in a blue bubble, and I admire and support you all, in the sense you're the oxygen that keeps the blue bubbles bouncing, but we're floating in a Red Sea. And the Red Sea is not the press, the Red Sea is TV. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is the elephant in the room that we haven't addressed. Mm-hmm. There are forces that determine what are the sound bites that resonate. And I have the feeling, I'm really amazed as I travel outside my blue bubble, how keywords that are dropped across the rest of the nation do have everybody obsessing about delay or Enron or whatever. And so I'd like you to talk a little bit more about what has now been dubbed infotainment. Mm. I'm delighted that you exist and you feed us inside the blue bubble, but the blue bubbles do not dominate the voters. So give us a thought, how do things travel from inside the blue bubble to the sound bites that determine what people think is important as they go to the voting booth, which is where democracy operates?
Well, nothing like print guys getting a chance to whack TV around, I know. Go ahead. Just a quick...
This is from somebody who appears weekly on TV.
Absolutely. two quick points. One, the good news is that the Internet is not crowding out print. Maybe it's beginning to crowd out TV. You wonder where the people who read and write the blogs and who spend all of this time in front of screens that are keep getting smaller and smaller, where do they find the time? Well, they either multitask themselves, which I think is just insane. I like nothing better than walking down the street without an iPod and just having my thoughts to myself. Maybe I'm very old-fashioned. But I would like to think that the Internet, which ultimately is print, by the way, is crowding out TV. How does our stuff percolate out? I think in two ways. Ellen Goodman, the Boston Globe columnist, the other day got off an absolutely wonderful line that I wish I'd written. She said, political change occurs when people learn what they know. And I think the purpose of magazines like this is to validate the lived experience of people in allowing people to understand that what they experience is a private, personal frustration actually has a political dimension to it. And I'm happiest when somebody who's a union organizer or a community activist or an elected official says to me, you know, that article that you published, that helped me understand X, or that gave me some language that I could use to persuade my brother-in-law, or that helped me write a speech. Because I think even though the media is a Red Sea, the country really isn't a Red Sea. At the very pinnacle of the Bush success, the country was divided 50-50, and now Bush is setting records for low popularity. And so the challenge is to sort of crash through the coarseness, as Victor put it, of TV, the simple-mindedness, and the right-wing tilt of TV, and help people learn what they know.
I would add just two points about television. One is from the late Neil Postman, who wrote, I think, a very important book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. And Neil would point out that, you know, the really insidious thing about television is not the content of the programs,
right. But
that the way it moves from famine in Darfur to now this, and then in between, Neil would say, let me say, if in the middle of my lecture tonight I said, let me stop now. I want to say a word on behalf of Calvin Klein Jeans. And then went on, and then 2 minutes later said, let me just stop. I want to say something about Burger King. And you can get these Whoppers at Burger King. He said, you wouldn't think I was a serious person. And you wouldn't think that I took the subject seriously. Well, television has habituated a generation, generations of our citizens to accept that and not take politics or culture seriously. There is such a thing as remedial reading. There's no such thing as remedial television watching. Everybody does it, and they do it. So that's the bad news about it and its impact on us. And maybe the internet is going to make that worse. Who knows? I don't know. I mean, but the good news is I went to a meeting here when the Democrats met here at the last presidential convention at the Kennedy School, and they had a meeting of all of the then anchors, that none of them, alas, with us, Peter Jennings, Tom Brokaw, Dan Rather. It was Judy Woodruff, it was moderated by Jim Lehrer of the Nightly NewsHour. And in the question period, someone got up and said, why is it young people don't watch, say they don't watch the nightly news anymore? They watch they watch Stewart and Jon Stewart. And so all of the panelists agreed that it's because they're too stupid to know the difference between satire and the real thing. And I'm sitting there saying, hey, just a minute. They watch him because he's very funny, number one. But they also, he has one thing that none of them have, which is they all go through the ritual or the pretense of narrative neutrality as if they had no politics of their own. Whereas the joy of being involved with a magazine like American Prospect or The Nation, or National Review for that matter, is that you're open about your politics. And Jon Stewart never says anything he doesn't believe because he's in the business of exposing hypocrisy. Now, one of the consequences of the fall-off in the watching of the nightly news is that there isn't a this common experience that all people used to have anymore. And that has some negatives, and it may have turned out to have some positives attached to it, it seems to me.
Yeah, well, I'm sort of in the soundbite business. I work for National Public Radio. And I think we do a pretty good job with our sound bites. But I would say this. Do you know, only about 300,000 people watch MSNBC. And I think the figure for CNN is 400,000. Of course, it's a million or so for Fox. But that's all. That's talk about a church. So, first of all, they don't really reach all that many people. With this kind of stuff. And secondly, the cable people need guests. They need talking heads. And I have seen Katerina on I don't know how many shows arguing for perspectives that never got on television before. You know, I only wish Michael Harrington were alive, who was my hero. He was a wonderful man, worked for the Catholic Worker and Dorothy Day in New York, was a democratic socialist. One of the people, the author of the Other America, which discovered poverty in the 60s. And my God, to think what he would be like on these shows. I mean, it's just so terrible that he isn't around. But we get Katerina, we get, you know, a variety. I mean, you've been on these programs. So I guess I'm mixed about it. You do get O'Reilly, but, you know, that's already spoken for, right? That's, you know, I mean, in other words, people are, that's like a low-grade infection. People have to go and get some more of it. But But basically, on the other shows, you've got to have guests, and they want clash. So you've got to have people over here on the right, you've got to have people on the left. Now, sometimes they're not equal. But so I think that even cable has this thing going for it. You know, you got to have the, and I, as I say, I can't turn on the dial, but Katerina is right there,
right,
plugging away.
Yes.
So,
you know, there's one other thing, which is, and I don't agree with it, but there's a book called The Soundbite Society by Jeffrey Scheuer, who argues that the reason the right predominates on television is that the message of the left doesn't lend itself to sound bites, whereas the message of the right does. Now, I have an argument with him, but that's, he makes this case, and it's worth reading.
One thing, Jack, it always amazes me, though, how many liberals actually go on O'Reilly's show in some misguided attempt to think that they can somehow get the better of him or joust with him.
I once went on the show, and he said to me, he said, "You're brave, Mr. Novasky, because I teach at the Columbia Journalism School. Your colleagues at Columbia are cowards. They refuse to come on the show." I said, "I'm not brave. I just have the free time." I said, "They're busier than I am. They can't waste their time coming on your program."
And did you come out intact?
I came out intact, but I haven't been invited back lately.
Then you did. Then obviously you did well. Did we have one more question?
Mr. Novasky has spoken about what goes on over the nation, that it's not merely preaching to the choir. You've got all these debates and contentiousness. And you gave us a few examples, but it seems to me that it's merely, you know, leftists arguing with the leftists as to who's more pure leftist. But so that's why I was chagrined when Christopher Hitchens, his departure, came out of nowhere. Over the war, essentially. Now, I don't know what's going on behind the scenes. Is there something personal going on? But wouldn't it have been a nice thing, Mr. Novasky, to have Christopher Hitchens stay on and do his thing and write the same things he's writing now and see what reaction you get from letter writers
and
see who will abandon ship and see what happens? That would have been a lot of fun, I think.
I agree with you.
Along with that,
I agree with you, and that's why we said it when he wrote his column saying goodbye. We said, "Come back, Christopher. We'll miss you. We really, you called your column Minority Opinion, and you should stick around and persuade others that, you know, of your view." Actually, he's writing a review for us right now, but people have their personal differences, but he left over public issues, and he did it against the will of Katrina and myself, and there were a lot of people who were glad to see him go, but I don't count myself among them. So.
Let me argue the opposite side of the case.
Sure.
I think, not specifically about Hitchens, but I think the general point, the right-wing press is so well-funded and so pervasive. I mean, we don't have anything like the Wall Street Journal editorial page. The New York Times tries to be very moderately, very politely liberal. The Washington Post used to be liberal. It isn't anymore. We don't have anything like Fox. And we have to break our backs to raise the money to keep these publications afloat. I don't apologize at all for not publishing conservatives. Conservatives have plenty of places to publish. And I get submissions all the time from people who want to use the American Prospects pages to attack liberals, to say, you know, liberals are really out to lunch about national defense, or liberals are really ought to be more open to privatization of Social Security. I mean, my point is, I didn't go to all this trouble to give an outlet to right-wingers. They've got plenty of outlets. I went to all this trouble, thank you, to help people of broad liberal convictions hone arguments. And we're a very broad church, like Victor. We publish a lot of people who disagree with each other, but who have in common a basic commitment to liberal values. And I don't apologize for that at all.
I agree with you, by the way, but I think Christopher doesn't qualify as a conservative. He is idiosyncratic, contrarian,
yes, that's true.
And he's Christopher. So.
Right.
We're going to have to wrap. I want to ask one very quick question of Bob and Victor. I went online and looked at the covers of the respective magazines. The Nation, the issue of The Nation has a picture of George Bush bobbing his head up out of a toilet bowl.
Subtle.
A reflection of bad poll numbers. Okay. The Prospect has a cover headline that says, "What's the big idea?" suggesting that Democrats should better finally figure out how to make hay from those low poll numbers in time for the off-year elections, fundamentally, which raises very different approaches to the same issue, which raises one question for me. Do you guys have, and I don't know how to put it other than more fun? Is it more fun? Is it more interesting? And is it more energizing for you guys when George Bush is in the White House or when Bill Clinton is in the White House?
Well, I just, again, as speaking as Nation Emeritus, we had a line for years that if it's bad for the country, it's good for the nation. And then people would say, how are you doing? Lately, I said, better than ever, because the country is in a lot of trouble. But, you know, you would hate to think that your fortunes or your fund depended on having people in power who you think are the consequence of whose policies is going to be at the destruction of the planet. And so it's a double curse. But the people, at least that I know at the Nation, are never rooting for those who they disagree with because they think it will be good for business.
Well, it's wonderful fun editing a magazine. That said, I think it's two different kinds of unfun. Certainly not fun having George Bush be president, even if it's good for business, because you fear for your country. Now, when Bill Clinton was president, that was 2 years into our existence, and he was a reader of the magazine, and Stan Greenberg had written a couple of pieces that influenced him, and Paul Starr was the author of the disastrous health plan and went to work for the administration. Bob Reich became Secretary of Labor. So we had all of these overlaps with the administration, and we spent a lot of time just despairing watching Clinton screw it up. So that was a different kind of unfun, and we haven't been around long enough to have the kind of fun that you have when Roosevelt's president.
And Jack, I'll ask you one quick question. The cover of The Atlantic, of course, is a cover story on Desert One, a look back at the failed hostage rescue effort that doomed Jimmy Carter's presidency in 1980, and I'm just guessing, along with the Jim Fallows piece, that's some not-so-subliminal warning about the option of military action against Iran, or am I reading too much into that?
Oh, gosh. Well, there, that's an interesting connection. I just don't know. I don't know what the story on that one is. It's a piece of narrative journalism about this event. And maybe that's the subject.
Timing,
yeah, I like
timing
that.
Was interesting. Yeah. Hey, I want to thank our speakers. Thank you, Victor Novasky. Thank you, Jack Beatty. Thank you, Bob Kuttner. Nice round of applause. You've been listening to a program of Cambridge Forum recorded in April 2006, co-sponsored by the Brookline Adult and Continuing Education, the Friends of Fairstead, and the Friends of Cambridge Forum. For more information about this radio program entitled Journals of Opinion, featuring Victor Novasky, Jack Beatty, and Robert Kuttner, or about our ongoing radio series, visit us on the web at www.cambridgeforum.org. In Boston, I'm Mark Jerkowitz. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.